The reading this morning is from Luke 16, verses 14 and 15. The Pharisees, who were lovers of money, heard all these things, and they ridiculed him. And he said to them, "You are those who justify yourselves before men, but God knows your hearts. For what is exalted among men is an abomination in the sight of God."
Good morning. I ran across a wonderful story about a man named Terry Watanabe. Terry was, interestingly enough, became the CEO of the Oriental Trading Company at the age of 20. His father had started the company way back in the 1920s in Japan, making small toys and selling them to children. In 1932, he moved to the United States, and under Terry's leadership, the company became a multi-million dollar toy order company, a big empire of sorts. By the year 2000, the trading company was bringing in $300 million a year. That's a lot of money. $300 million a year. Terry decided he would sell the company, and so he sold the company for an undisclosed amount of money, but a rather large sum of money, undoubtedly. And he decided he would sort of devote himself, he said, to, interestingly enough, he's going to devote himself to helping others and having fun. Interesting language. Devote himself to helping others and having fun. It's really interesting because he told the Omaha World Herald, quote, "If it's not fun, it's not worth doing." And so a very rich man, part of our nation's elite power brokers, had it all. And then he lost everything. His plans to help others went by the wayside because he decided that wasn't as much fun as he thought it would be. And so what he started doing was drinking and gambling. And in fact, he made several trips to Las Vegas, and he would gamble there. Supposedly, he lost $204 million in gambling. $204 million. Gambling at two different casinos. A man who had it all, money, power, friends, servants, gave it all up for the desire, for his desires and pleasure. There was a great reversal. Everything sort of went the other way. It's kind of shocking that a man can lose $204 million in 1 year, but he lost $204 million in a single year. His life is a good example of a man who, of the great reversal. How things are really reversed. Jesus gives us an illustration in our text in Luke chapter 16 of this great reversal. And it's really interesting because you can even see it in the Matthew 19 text that I have on the screen. Many of the first will end up last and the last first. I have a colleague who did his doctoral dissertation on the book of Luke. And he did it on the book of Luke, and he said the whole book of Luke is a story about a great reversal. Folks on the top end up on the bottom, and folks on the bottom end up on the top. And in a very real way, our text today is one of those very stories. You may remember the text that we read together just a moment ago is a text from Matthew chapter 16 after Jesus has just told this parable about this unrighteous steward. And he says the steward was shrewd and he planned for his future, but he really was a fellow who was very dishonest. And Jesus, after telling that parable, the Pharisees will turn to him because they're lovers of money. They're listening to all the things he's saying and they're scoffing at him. They're making fun at him. They're laughing at what he has to say. And it's really interesting because Jesus is going to give us a second parable which really addresses the same issue, but in a different way. The text begins, "Now there was a rich man, and he habitually dressed in purple and fine linen, joyously living in splendor every day." It's really an interesting text. This text begins with this unusual parable And I'm convinced it's a parable of Jesus, but it's an unusual parable of Jesus. A lot of folks want to suggest this isn't even a parable. It doesn't begin like most parables, although it begins just like the last parable began with this phrase, "Now there was a rich man." It begins the same way as that. And it's the only parable in which a man is named. We're going to get a man named Lazarus in this story. And so we begin with this story with this rich man. His name is not given. We have no idea what the rich man's name is. We're going to know about the poor man, and we'll know his name. But we don't know the rich man's name. Sometimes folks will suggest his name is Dives, which is really, interestingly enough, the Latin translation of the word rich man. And so they gave him a name, but he doesn't have a name. He is unnamed in our text. He's dressed in fine linen, fine purple. His clothes would be very, very expensive. It's the kind of clothing that you'd expect a king to wear. And so he's dressing in a way and probably eating things that even the rich folks of his day didn't enjoy. He eats in splendor every single day. He enjoys probably meat at every meal. Back in those days, most folks had bread at most meals. But this man is enjoying everything. The point is, he's very much like the Pharisees in the last part of our text a few moments ago. He has a large house, and we'll discover that his house even has a gate. And so we'll learn a bit about that gate in just a moment. But here we learn a bit about another man. And a poor man named Lazarus was laid at his gate covered with sores and longing to be fed with the crumbs which were falling from the rich man's table. Besides, even the dogs were coming and licking his sores. Our fellow now is given a name. His name is Lazarus, and in reality, that's a sort of shortened form of Eliezer. Eliezer means literally, it's a phrase that means God helps. In fact, God is indeed going to help this man, and that will be important to us. He is brought and laid at the gates to this man's house because the assumption is if you can get him there, when the rich man goes past, at least he'll drop something and give him something, some money perhaps, and he'll help this poor fella as he walks through. Our fella is indeed a beggar. He's a poor beggar. He's covered all over with sores, and he's longing to eat. He'll eat anything. You may remember the parable of the prodigal son, where he's not being fed and he's tempted to even eat the pods that are being given to the pigs. But here is a guy who will eat even the crumbs that are falling from the table. Interestingly enough, in their day, you didn't have napkins, but one of the things you would do if you were a rich guy is you would use the bread to clean, to rub your hands, and you just sort of toss it down and you'd give it to the dogs or to the beggar. And so he's tempted to eat anything. Poor fella. Besides that, even the dogs, and these are not pets, these are dogs that are wild dogs, are coming and they're licking his sores and he can't even shoo them off. What a sad story. You see how they start out? The rich guy has everything and the poor guy has nothing. And that's the beginning of the story. But it doesn't end there. Now the poor man died and was carried away by the angels to Abraham's bosom. The rich man died and was buried. I love the way the story goes. You see the reversal already? The poor man dies and the angels come and carry him away to Abraham's bosom. Abraham's bosom is another way of saying paradise. For the Jews of the day, it would be heaven. He's carried away to heaven. And he's off in this grand place. And he's carried there by the angels. The rich man dies and he's just buried. You see the big contrast here? Angels come to this poor man's aid, but the poor man is just put in a grave, and that's all there is to it. He's just buried. The text goes on to say, "In Hades he lifted up his eyes, being in torment, and saw Abraham far away, and Lazarus in his bosom." So our fellow wakes up in Hades. And by the way, the word Hades is equal to the Old Testament word Sheol. It's another word to say the grave. The realm of the dead. But here, clearly, since he's going to be in torment, we will learn that it really is, for the average Jew, they're going to see that as hell. He wakes up in hell. It's interesting because a lot of folks want to use this text to try to explain what happens to you the moment you die. That's not the design of this parable. The parable is designed to give us another message altogether. And so here he is, he wakes up in Hades. For the Jews, seeing from hell, seeing heaven is an important thing, because you can see how bad it is if you see how good it is on the other side. The contrast is going to be significant. And for the folks up here who are enjoying heaven and enjoying the presence of God, for them to see how bad it would have been had they gone the other place, it would be even better. And so the contrast is a significant one. So he sees Abraham there, and he sees Lazarus at his bosom, and leaning over against him, right up next to good old Abraham, Father Abraham. And he cried out and said, "Father Abraham, have mercy on me." Interestingly enough, the time of mercy is already passed for this man. You see, it's beyond the time of grace. He's not going to get any grace now. He's asking for grace. "Have mercy on me. Send Lazarus so that he may dip the tip of his finger in water and cool my tongue, for I am in agony in this flame." You see how hell sounds, how bad it sounds. He is so thirsty that he would be glad to have just a drop of water. But do you also notice that he knows our man Lazarus by name? Even though Lazarus had been outside his house all along and he's that poor guy, he knows Lazarus by name. Has he helped him? No, not really. But he really sees Lazarus almost as a servant. You know, have him come and do something for me. Have him dip his finger in some water and put it on my tongue and cool my tongue. Interesting language, right? You see the great reversal that is happening here in the text. "But Abraham said, 'Child, remember that during your life you received good things, and likewise Lazarus bad things. But now he's being comforted here, and you are in agony.'" You see the great reversal? Here's a guy who was a poor guy who had nothing, and he was in real agony while he was living, and now he is enjoying the presence of Abraham, the great father, and the presence of God, and all the wonders of heaven. He's enjoying all those grand things. And here, this fella who had everything is now experiencing agony. And so the real reversal is good. And so it's really going to be significant. Besides all this, between us and you, there's a great chasm fix, so that those who wish to come over from here to you are not able, and none may cross from there to us. He describes the difference, the distance between heaven and hell as a great chasm. You can't make this contrast. Once you've lived your life, there is no change. The fixed chasm, perhaps to keep the bad guys out and the good guys there where they're supposed to be. But there's this fixed chasm between them. And I think it's really quite interesting, again, to see this contrast that's being portrayed here in our text. He said, "Then I beg you, Father, that you send to my father's house. I have five brothers, in order that he may warn them, so that they will not come to this place of torment. Would you do me a favor then? Could you at least send good old Lazarus back home to my family? I've got five brothers, and you know my five brothers have been a lot like me. And I'm afraid they're going to end up here just like me. I don't want them to go to hell. I'd like you to go there, and I want you to warn them. I want him to warn them to keep them out of this terrible place of torment." But Abraham's response is interesting. Abraham said, "They have Moses and the prophets. Let them hear them." They've got Moses and the prophets. They've got the scriptures. They know what they're supposed to do. They know the kind of life they should live. He said, "No, Father Abraham, but if someone goes to them from the dead, they'll repent." If somebody is raised from the dead, it'll turn them all around. He said to them, "If they don't listen to Moses and the prophets, they won't be persuaded, even if someone rises from the dead." In a very real way, Jesus is paving the way with a message for those Pharisees. You know what? Even after I die, and after I'm raised from the dead, those folks still aren't going to believe. If they don't believe and they don't take seriously the message of God now, they're not going to take it seriously even if somebody comes back from the dead again. A lot of those folks will not be believers. The miracles of Jesus won't convince them. I have this wonderful quote from a man named Marshall in his commentary. He says, "Miracles will not convince those whose hearts are morally blind and unrepentant." If you're blind morally and you don't really repent, you're not going to be convinced even if Jesus comes back to life again. Unbelief is not because of lack of evidence. They've got evidence. They have the evidence from the Moses and the prophets. And if they're not going to hear Moses and the prophets, they're not even going to hear when somebody comes back from the dead again. They're not going to get it. It becomes an important message. It is really this message of that great reversal. You have this guy who starts out rich and ends up in hell, and the guy who starts out poor and ends up in heaven. And he's grand. There's this grand reversal. And the danger is that that can be the case. The passage is one, I think, that is a striking one for us. You see, we have this Jesus who has come back from the dead again. And hopefully all of us have become believers because of that. We've seen, we've heard this wonderful story of the resurrection of Jesus, and it really makes a difference to us because we have the right kind of hearts. Perhaps there are others who just will not believe and cannot bring themselves to faith. We're going to sing a song as an invitation song, and it may well be that you've come to believe because you've learned the story of Jesus and you've learned of his resurrection from the dead and you've heard this wonderful story, but you understand the great reversal for those who are not real believers. Those are the folks who are going to reap the consequence. If you need to respond to that invitation today to confess Jesus as Lord, to be buried in baptism, we'd be happy to assist you in doing that. Perhaps there are others who just need some prayers. And again, we'd be happy to do that as well. If you need to come, would you come as we stand and as we sing?